Les séminaires du Collège de France.
So, it's a pleasure for me to introduce Dirk Hartmann. This enters in the seminar where we try to link academic mathematics and industrial mathematics. And in this sense, Dirk defines himself as a technology leader, industrial mathematician, and intrapreneur in the field of simulation and digital twin. So which I think is match perfectly with the aim of this seminar. So he's a distinguished key expert at Siemens Digital Industry Software, where he leads the SimCenter Technology Innovative Team. And he is also a professor at TU Darmstadt, where he is heading a chair in digital twin. So he has a very big team in industry, and he has also students. So I let him present his research on digital twins.
Yeah, so thanks a lot for the very, very kind introduction. Yes, my English is not good as my French, or vice versa, rather. So I'll stick with English. Yes, my day job, it's all about digital twins. So very happy to tell you about digital twins and my view on that, and specifically how much of the stuff you've seen in this lecture, the lecture before, really finds its way into applications. And that is really what more or less drives me, drives my teams, take mathematics and enable through mathematics really digital twins and the way also industry is operating today. Of course, there's lots of hype around digital twins. There's lots of hype around AI and machine learning, and I truly believe mathematics can help to ground all that hype and to really understand, okay, what can we expect in reality. So this is a bit an out very, very rough outline on the talk. Of course, that's contribution from many, many, many collaborators. I'll refer to them mostly through the references in the presentation. Still, I'd like to start. The focus is on industry. Why is really Siemens excited about digital twins? Why is this relevant? Very often when I speak to audience like this, to students, etc., yes, Siemens, you might think of the fridge, you might think of the gas turbines, you might think of the computer tomographs, but all that is not really anymore in the core of Siemens. Yes, it still holds the label of Siemens, but it's not our core business. Our core business has evolved over the last 10 years towards automation on the one hand side, automating factories, automating buildings as examples, of course, still also on the mobility side. But in parallel, we built up as a company really a huge digital portfolio. And that really goes back to the vision of the boss here, Roland Busch, president and CEO of Siemens, with his ambition or statement that Siemens is able to combine the real and digital worlds like no other company, and that, of course, boils then down to digital twins. But what does that mean, and how does that connect specifically to mathematics? And basically, over the last 10 years, we've bought many, many different software companies, or Siemens bought many different software companies. The latest addition is the Altair company. And so we have actually a quite huge portfolio of simulation tools. Yes, anything you could imagine to simulate in an industrial setting, mechanical analysis, electrodynamics, computational fluid dynamics, chemistry, on a systems level, whatever you might imagine, you find in our portfolio, which at a very, very high level is branded SimCenter. And that is basically the part where I'm leading the technology innovation team. I'm trying to reimagine how will SimCenter look, how will our offering look in a few years, and how will that change in the end industrial practice. Before starting now with mathematical, or not mathematical, with some kind of definitions of digital twin, etc., let's rather start with a few examples where I truly believe the way how we interact with, still prefer to call it modeling, simulation, optimization. Now that is what in the end digital twins are about, how that will change the way we operate in industry on the one hand side, then still explain a bit what is my view on digital twins, where are specifically the challenges, where is mathematics needed, then two examples, a bit more of a deep dive where also some of the methods we've seen this morning are being used actually in our products to scale then digital twins. And then deep dive also, because I really believe it's something, you know, I used to put aside quite a lot, probably the mathematics community is putting quite a lot aside, is classic, or not classical, is AI in the form of these large language models. Still like to highlight also how these can play a role for digital twins and why they're probably even crucial to realize digital twins in the end, and then wrap up. Finally, let's start with examples. What is our research about? What is the next upcoming innovations about? So this is probably the most classical example, computational fluid dynamics simulation of a car. In this case, used to run thousands of core hours on HPCs, on an HPC cluster. Here, that is less than 10 hours on a couple of GPUs, where we simulate a CFD with, I think, a few million degrees of freedom. So on the one hand side, yes, all our research, the innovation is pushing what we have been doing in the past, just making it faster and more accurate. And most of the stuff, as well as this, you'll see tons of nice visualizations because on the one hand side, it looks fancy in a presentation like this. On the other hand, it's also very, very crucial to explain what digital twins are about. At least that is something I have learned in the past years. Yes, many of the stuff, like in this case, you're interested in the DRAC, not really in the detailed flow fields. Still, if you have a nice video animation, it speaks more than just a single number. As said, this is probably the boring part of it, the very classical use of simulation in computer-aided engineering, but we are guessing much faster in terms of speed and more accurate in predictions. So the question is, if we are reaching that boundary, what can we do next? What can we do next? That is actually a quite old demo, but in this philosophy, yes, we have this massive computing power at hand. Can't we do real-time engineering? Yes, can't we give the engineers a tool where they can really simply experiment as they used to do in their experimental side to understand how systems are working? In this case, it is a finite element simulation in real time. I think it's a million finite elements here, so 3 million degrees of freedom, linear static analysis. You can exert forces wherever you would like and see immediately the reaction of that structure where you would see stresses. And that can then help to understand where troubles are and speed up the design process. I very much like to highlight this example because in the last 2 years, I've seen many of these demos from the machine learning community where they have a big machine learning model in the end doing real-time predictions. But this is really a very classical finite element simulation put on a GPU and then the appropriate solver, so geometric multigrid method as a preconditioner, etc., to get towards real-time, so not to forget the mathematics, being too excited about machine learning. But getting more interactive here allows, of course, giving these tools into hands of people who have not been using them before, on the one hand side. On the other hand, this also can enable us to really bring simulation into use cases where it has not been used before. This is another example. How can we use simulation actually during the operation of systems, in this case, of motors? And use this as additional sensor information to take operational decisions. This is just a very small setup to explain, to demonstrate a bit what this is about. This should be actually large drives. Large drives means those two drives would fill this room probably entirely. And these large drives are typically used, for example, to drive compressors in the oil and gas industry. In these plants, uptime is everything, and in some very specific situations, those large drives are limited by thermal effects. So the question is, can we predict the thermal behavior in real time by means of a reduced order model? And that is what we've demonstrated here. So obviously, on the one hand side, there is this nice and fancy visualization. On the other hand, the solution allows to predict temperatures on the rotor, which you cannot measure by sensors. And now you would have, or now you have through that additional digital twin, through that real-time simulation, a motor temperature, and can feed back that motor temperature into the control, and that will allow the operators to start up those motors 10, 20 minutes maybe earlier. But if you look what an hour of operation these oil and gas plants cost, that is quite a huge amount of money. Now you might argue, okay, this is thermal effects, that's parabolic elliptic equations, so however you look at this, boring from a mathematical point of view. Also, you have lots of time to predict, yes, because if you speak thermal effects, that's probably on the time scale of minutes. So we tried to push that even further in the extreme. Again, a bit older example, but these days also everybody speaks about robotics. So the question was here, can we use such a robot to actually mill metal? You might have seen similar robots to mill foam, to mill wood, but not metal. The reason is quite simple. The process forces which actually occur during this milling process is a couple of hundred Newton. A couple of hundred Newton leads really to a deformation because in the end it's not a very stiff system, such a robot, to a millimeter of that robot. And of course, if you're a millimeter or 2 millimeters apart from the intended geometry, you cannot use that geometry any further for industrial tasks. So that's why nobody so far considered really to use robots for milling or standard robots for milling. Of course, you can put in tons of additional hardware to make them super stiff so that you don't see this deviations or deflections due to the force of the milling process. Again, what we did here is a bit similar to the previous also lecture. Yes, there's an online-offline decomposition, so we try to compute as much upfront offline. In this case, we compute offline somehow the amount of material to be removed, and then online predict the forces to be expected, and then the reaction of the robot, how much would the robot be actually deflect due to that. Compensate that, and this is the result, what you see. This would be, for some test piece, the misalignment of the intended geometry to the actually produced geometry due to the reflections. So it's plus minus 1 millimeter at various parts. As said, plus minus 1 millimeter is not even sufficient for the roughening tasks. So for the roughening tasks, which is the first step of removing most of the material, expectation is something 0.1, 0.2 millimeters in accuracy. But if you switch on the digital twin, predict the expected deflections or deformations, and then compensate for them, and there is no big sophisticated model predictive control or so involved here. It's just moving. If we predict a deflection 1 millimeter to the right, the robot is just moved 1 millimeter to the left. And as said, this is a challenging application because we need to predict forces accurately and anticipated deformations on the order or submillimeter accuracy, while the whole workpiece can be a couple of meters in size. And at the same time, the robot is expecting control signals in the order of milliseconds. So also we have extreme reaction times we need here. And then, of course, in order to cope with latencies to really provide the prediction in the right time, we actually need to do the simulation on the control, so we also need to cope here with a very, very limited amount of compute power. And yet another example, again a thermal management system. This is a bit predicting the thermal behavior of a battery. All these examples so far we've seen is to support operators of these systems to do better decisions because they have more information through these real-time models. Speaking about physical AI, robotics, yes, you put these robots, these artificial intelligence models, into gaming engines, into virtual worlds, into the metaverse, where you train these systems, and of course also there you would like to have much, much more accurate simulation models, and this would be again a thermal model of a battery, which then can be used to fine-tune controllers of batteries, let's say of cars, of robots, because many of these systems are limited by thermal effects and they need super accurate models to then train appropriate machine learning controllers for these systems. There's a set of selected examples we had been working on. trying to really see what can you do, taking the classical modeling simulation optimization technologies and use cases and take them to the operations part of those systems, which from my point of view, at least, the digital twins is really about. Yes, computer-aided engineering technology, or as a philosophy, virtual engineering was already there. The new element the digital twins brought really to span the complete life cycle. But of course, also the challenges, if you look at these systems, are quite different. Yes, depending on what you look. Well, first of all, different physics for various reasons, different discretizations, different numerical schemes in the background, different length scales, different requirements and accuracies, different requirements on the compute infrastructure, different users of these tools. And that already demonstrates a bit the difference of the digital twin in terms of complexity if you would compare it to classical virtual design and engineering. And this also then comes to the challenge, let's say, to define what is actually a digital twin. So can we find a scope, a framework to speak about digital twins? I tried this several times to come up with a good definition of a digital twin, but then actually gave up in the end because I didn't find a definition of a digital twin where not someone could come and say, I have an Excel table with the core KPIs of my system and I update this from week to week, you know, that this would not fall into the category of a digital twin. So I rather prefer to speak about, you know, paradigm of a digital twin than trying to give a rigorous definition. There's also the QR code, and please reach out later to me. I can also share all the slides with you. QR code leads to a more fancy explainer we did together with our communication department, what are digital twins, but this is really more or less my quintessence on what digital twins are. A set of digital models accepted as full substitutes and as full substitutes to take a decision for a very specific purpose. And I think I like this very much, yes, because this also has all the, you know, what is the speed you require, what is the accuracy required, etc. As long as you accept that to take a decision based on virtual information and that is good enough for you as a substitute, then that would be a digital twin. And of course, the very key here is because it is used during operations, later life cycle phases, not only during the virtual design, this bidirectional interaction is also very crucial for the digital twin. But having this very, very broad definition and coming from a company and also a background where all these methods were really only used in the design phase, we need to very fundamentally change or extend our toolbox of methods what we have. Yes, if this would be today, then on the one hand side, and that's probably the natural thing we do, yes? We would like to go to much, much finer and more accurate phenomena. We would probably like to go down the chemistry scale because, you know, chemistry of the battery might be very relevant for the thermal behavior. And on the other side, would like to go very much up in the scale and look at systems of systems to really manage the complexity not only of today's product, but I think this is also where the digital twins then become super useful to bridge all these scales. Probably what's happening, has happened, is happening naturally at the moment in the complete computer-aided engineering industry going in those two directions, but there is additional elements coming, speaking about digital twins. On the one hand side is this what's called in the industry shift left, yes, using digital models much, much earlier than you would do in the virtual design. For example, why not handing out the sales guys digital models so that they could, based on these models, do more quantitative analysis of requirements, do more accurate bids or provide more accurate offers to customers, so to improve the sales process. I mean, that would be a very, very extreme shift left, but obviously also during early concept design, use much, much more physics-informed decision and not only at the end of the stage for validation. And then the whole core idea set of the digital twin is this extension of along the complete life cycle. So you really use these digital models for decision support during operations. And then, of course, that has very extreme requirements and tough requirements in terms of real-time prediction, where all the reduced order modeling is really coming in very important to achieve this. Then there is another element which I think is probably the most important of those all, is who is the users of these digital twins. The computer-aided engineering industry has and still is selling to very educated engineers, master degree, very often a PhD, as users, and still, you know, it takes them a couple of years to get super fluent, super effective in these tools. But this crowd of people we currently sell into, which are using our tool, is a very limited crowd. Yes? So there's, of course, the demographic issue, there's funding of the universities, et cetera, et cetera. So we cannot expect these users to grow. So if we really would like to address digital twins, we need to tap into or enable other users to use digital twins. On the one hand side, this is what we call here shift down, is the democratization of simulation. And on the other hand is what we call the shift up, so making stuff much, much more autonomous. And the example you will see at the end is really how to enable a large language model actually to run a simulation, at least under certain limitations, so that you can take the human there out of the loop. And of course, in parallel, well, our compute landscape is changing rapidly. I think we've very well adapted now from this switch from general purpose CPUs to massively parallel compute units like GPUs, tensor processing units, etc. So more or less the hardware being driven by the AI and machine learning community, because in the end they are much, much bigger consumers, so they will set the future architecture standards. So I think there we are well underway, but then of course, speaking about digital twins, we need to compute at the edge, we need to compute on the control. And on the other hand, of course, also the compute landscape is changing to the very extreme neuromorphic computing, quantum computing, and the like. And I think this is also the reason, if you go back to this study from national academies of the US looking into digital twins, and they have the statement, yes, despite examples of digital twins providing practical impact and value, so kind of the examples I showed you up front, the publicity around the digital twins really currently outweighs the evidence base of success. And I think that that is a very, very true statement, probably not only for digital twins. I mean, many for much of the stuff we are seeing currently. But I think we're doomed to make digital twins a success in the end, because this will be the only way to manage the increase in complexity of our technologies, of our product systems, but on the other hand also to manage all the challenges coming with this, yes, reducing the carbon footprint, etc. Without digital twins, it will not work. So I think we absolutely need to make sure there is an evidence base of success. This is a bit a survey I picked up, which was looking really into simulation. I think, okay, digital twins are coming from simulation, so it's probably a good point to see, okay, why aren't we adopting more and more simulation today? Because, I mean, this clearly holds then definitely also for digital twins. This is the core 6 points here. The first one being knowledge, yes, having knowledgeable users at the first hand, yes, and spoke already, you know, typical user, master's degree, PhD, and that gives you already a very high price tag on that person to hire, and that already limits probably the kind of companies who would hire that person. The time needed to set up these models, to pre-process and post-process simulation models. Today, it's really not anymore really the core solve time, but is the time required to pre-process, to build up the meshes, to clean the geometries, to post-process that information. It's not really the solve time, I mean, except if you go to real-time algorithms, to those real-time applications. Price, okay, you can always complain about the price, so I'll leave that out. Accuracy, so it's probably less, actually, if you speak to people, the missing accuracy of simulations, but it's, I would rather say, the lack to appropriately assess the accuracy. Yes, I've seen many, many people running simulations with 100 millions of finite elements as an example, where, you know, 100,000, a million would do sufficient, but they just lack a good feeling for the accuracy. Resources, we spoke about that. Well, and automation is probably more a solution than real challenge here. And this is really what I think we should have in mind when we do or look at novel mathematical methods to address really these challenges. And I think this is also the most interesting part. Of course, there is still lots of effort going into also on our side to evolve our solvers, etc. But this is really not addressing the core issues, the core limitations to really scale up, making more people using digital twins. There's tons of technology which make me in the way excited that this will happen. So this is probably more the very classical field we all have been working into. Yes, it's finding the right algorithms to leverage the available computer hardware, and that led then to computer-aided design, computer-aided engineering with the emergence of the first personal computers, etc., etc. With advancements in methods, reduced auto modeling as one example, GPUs, we are also getting there to more interactive digital twins. Much more to come on the computing side. But then data assimilation, I think, really calibration methods, data uncertainty quantification, we've done quite a few achievements have been developed. So really these models in the loop, having a digital twin running in parallel real time, being allowed to calibrate to the actual status, etc. Is there machine learning is complementing the toolbox. And last but not least, though I have very little understanding about the actual implementations except all these large language models, in the end it's a chain rule, but why is it working, etc. is probably not really my scope of expertise, but what we see also here in the thing I'll share at the end, managing appropriately the data, the knowledge in knowledge graph, this natural language processing, large language models, all this is very, very key to scale it in the end. I said at the bottom, knowledge and data, large language models, there's also some mathematics, but probably more alchemy than really true mathematics. Computer hardware is also not my business, but in all the rest, yes, this really has mathematical algorithms at its core, and getting them right is extremely crucial for all these applications we've seen so far, because at least in an industrial setting, yes, we very much care about accuracy. We very much care about reaching 99% and even higher prediction accuracies. We are not satisfied with, I get you roughly the right book recommendation. That's not enough. So that's why really I truly believe mathematics is needed. And there are a lot of these things is evolving. I claimed, okay, the future is bright. Let's see how bright this future really is. So there's a very nice paper of Vinod Vinge. Probably most of you haven't heard about him. He's a mathematician at the University of San Diego and a science fiction writer in parallel. And he wrote to this very, very nice piece back in the 90s for a NASA symposium, How to Survive in the Post-Human Era. Yes, a prediction for more or less today that machines will take over, because he got so excited about the exponential technology development he has seen in the 90s. So I think even though many of us are quite excited about the opportunities, it will probably take longer than expected. Still, let me give you a glimpse into the future, how we believe these methods, machine learning, reduced order modeling, mathematical innovations, can help us a bit to rethink how we operate the one or the other industrial asset. We can make it more efficient, more sustainable, etc. So this is the first challenge I've chosen here. Real-time model running within a system simulation, or in the back of the mind, always on a controller to have a more efficient control, in this case, of a battery. The battery is a very, very good example, because obviously we are electrifying like hell, cars, robot, whatever. And many of these effects are really limited by thermal effects. So in the end, yes, if you put this in a larger circuit to charge, discharge the battery, that leads to thermal effects in the battery. The battery heats up. This can lead to a thermal runaway. So severe damage, not only of the battery, but of the car, of the surrounding. I'm sure you've all seen these YouTube movies, mobile phone, computer exploding. That's absolutely to be avoided. So as an engineering side, you're super, super critical with limiting the way how you can operate the battery, but of course to run more efficiently, it would be interesting to see, okay, can we operate it a bit closer to the edge what is possible, but in order to do that we need a very good understanding of the thermal behavior of the battery. As a mathematician, this is of course good news, that thermal effects is a major limiting factor in many cases of our customers. Yes, because parabolic and elliptic equations are the nicest equations we know. So that's why I really also like to focus here on thermal systems. So the use case, the model here we are looking at is a complex multiphysics model, so you probably don't see it, but at the bottom those blue things are cooling channels, so you might have turbulent flow in there. There's a battery electrochemistry, there's electrical modeling in there, and you need a million, in this case, finite volume cells to simulate that. Whether the flow is really turbulent or whether a laminar approximation would do the job, whether a million finite volumes is too much, this is very much out of the discussion, yes, because engineers want to run that even at 10 or 100 million finite volumes to be really sure this is super, super accurate. Now the question is, can we put that somehow into a real-time mode? And despite my little understanding in French, I think very much of the stuff we'll see here, yes, singular value decomposition, POD, is what we are going to see how we are actually solving this. So this is a bit the concept we are advocating right now, and on which we are building all these prototypes, demonstrators for thermal management of any system. So yes, we start with the initial snapshots, so generate a set of typical scenarios to generate a simulation for these. Based on these, we identify a lower dimensional setting description of the system. Yes, a machine learning guy would call this latent dimension. Then we find the right model, the right operators, the right description of what's going on in this low-dimensional system. We call here operator inference. By operator inference, you'll see in the end. Then we do a prediction. In this case, what is very important for us, we do then an estimation of the accuracies of the prediction, because we figure out we are not enough. Sufficiently accurate in the prediction, we put in an active learning loop to generate additional data, so to avoid generating too much data upfront and to increase accuracy through this. Of course, the most general workflow you could think of. So this is kind of the ingredients you could use, yes, and for all of this you have a super large toolbox of ingredients. From our experience, if the geometry is not changing and if the geometry is fixed, yes, or if you can find a reparameterization to some geometry which stays fixed, then really POD, proper orthogonal decomposition, in the end singular value decomposition, is our method of choice, because it so nicely scales up. Even if you have 100 million cells, yes, you still have something where we have efficient algorithms to compute that in reasonable time frames. Whereas if you would do an autoencoder with an input of 100 million states, yes, then you might get into serious trouble or enormous cost to train these things. Then we do the reduced model discovery. Of course, there is also a big toolbox of systems. If you work with a linear representation like POD, of course, the natural approach, what you would do, would be a projection of the system matrices in this space. However, some of the solvers we work with, just because I don't have the knowledge in our team, are black box for us. And also many solvers are really matrix free. Yeah, so there is no matrix ever being built up which you could project down, or only with significant effort required to do these projections. So that's why our way how to operate here is the operator inference. I'll roughly explain what operator inference is. Was put forward by Benjamin Pehrsdorfer and Karen Wilcox, roughly 10 years ago. And it works extremely reliable and robust for our cases if you put in one or two tricks, and I'll tell you also the tricks you need to put into. And as said, an active learning that really helps us a lot to keep the data in control. So not to generate massive data, yes, because if that is systems with 100 million cells, you can imagine just to store the data is a pain, not even to speak about generating it. So active learning is an important element here for us. Active learning for us means we just run after the prediction a Gaussian process on the error. And then this basically tells us, okay, where do we have a good estimate for the error? Where are we unsure about the estimate of the error? And where is the error very high? And at those regions where we haven't a good estimate of the error, so where we have a big variance, or where we have a high mean, so where we see a high error, we just generate additional samples and then increase additional data to train the whole system. And as you will see, with ridiculously few data, you can get a highly accurate model here using this. A bit to the philosophy about how does this POD and differentiable operator inference works, and what is differential operator inference, I'll tell you in a minute. So I think POD, SVD, you've seen already in the lecture, I don't need to speak about that. So let me speak about the operator in inference here. So the idea of the operator inference is, you know, the discretization of, in that case, Navier-Stokes equation plus Tummel plus chemistry, whatever. So you know exactly the form of the equation. So typically, it's polynomial equations. If we know the form of the equations, and we would assume a spectral basis, yes, and the POD is nothing else than a spectral basis, we also know how the projection would look like. Yes, it would be just, again, a polynomial. So the core idea of the operator inference is run a regression problem to figure out the matrix entries. And of course, sounds very, very simple. Yes, you can just the least square problem. You can solve that extremely efficient. But the issue is, in practical setting, you need to have a very good estimator here of your time derivatives. So basically what you do is you look at each individual time step and then find your operator so that they exactly match the time step. And that requires a good estimate of the time step. I put here first order estimate based on the tangent. Actually, if you look at people who have implemented that in practical situation, they go up to estimates, eighth order approximations or whatever. So that's the first element you need to get right. The other element you need to get right is the regularization of this problem. And also that's lots of magic numbers. And if you don't get it right, if you have it too large, etc., you run into extreme troubles here getting stable matrices. Yes, we've seen many, many examples where all of a sudden, you know, it's a stable system. And even if it's a linear system, you end up with positive eigenvalues. And that's, of course, obviously absolutely to be avoided. Now, we have two elements to address this. There's quite some big work by Peter Benner and his team from the MPI in Magdeburg, as an example, putting in information you have about structures of the operators and how to enforce these structures in this inference process.
So here, the I is the time index?
Yes, the
I.
Let me check. Yes, the I should be the time index and J should be the trajectory time or simulation index. Yes, so we run over a couple of simulations and then each time step and we do individual time steps where we estimate or regress the operator. And that is actually what makes here the issue. So that's why what we said, okay, we coined differentiable operator inference. There's a thousand names how you might call it, how people call it. So the core idea is, instead of having a simple optimization problem, we formulate that in a constrained optimization problem. Yes, we are not only optimizing individual time step, but now we try to minimize a small step of a trajectory, a complete trajectory. Typically, that would be a trajectory of 10 to 20 time steps. And then, of course, that needs to be constrained by the simulator, which is predicting other stuff. As said, this has 1,000 different names. As a mathematician, you would probably say constrained optimization. As a control guy, you would say, hey, that is a reformulation of model predictive control. As a machine learning guy, you would say this is autoregressive training. As a machine learning guy out of the physics community, they call this solver in the loop. so thousands of different names, but this trick really made wonders. Just introducing that, unrolling, having that evolved over a couple of time steps, vanished all the stability issues, vanished the problems of getting the regularization right, etc. So super, super robust to do predictions with this system. And the benefit now of being a mathematician is, as a machine learning guy, what you would do is what they call unrolling, yes? You have these great Python frameworks, so you just write your solver in your Python framework. Actually, in the loss function, you write then or unroll the solver for 10 different time steps. You use automatic differentiation, let the automatic differentiation framework do the rest. But of course, that only writes if you have your solver in an automatic differentiation framework. Most industrial solvers are not. But the good thing is most of the industrial solvers have been tuned to solve these constraint optimization problems, yes? Because shape optimization, topology optimization, all these require you to solve these constraint optimization problems. And if you understand that from this point of view, yes, then you can reuse whatever a joint solver capability has been provided in those tools to actually reuse it in this training setup. As I said, yes, more robust and stable than classical operator inference. Of course, it's a bit more complex from a mathematical point of view. But since we really run here in this low-dimensional setting, yes, the typical basis we work with in these problems, 20 to 40 modes of the POD, yes, this is very, very well feasible, specifically if you compare that to the effort you put into this to generate the training data. So going a bit back to really explain, demonstrate that you can do this with ridiculously little data. So we start here with 15 long simulation. Long simulation means we simulate the system for 300 seconds and we change the current. Yes, all this is heated by the current flowing through the system only once. We run that at a high current, switch off or switch down to a lower current, and that's it. And we do 15 trajectories off this. Well, then you do the POD, and there's a bit, you know, how much memory, etc. Do you have? How long do you need to compute that? And that actually was the, you know, a plain POD implementation, nothing parallelized, or a plain SVD implementation. In I think Python, what we used here. So of course that you can tune even further. Well, then you have your estimators, etc. And the active learning loop. What we do in the active learning loop here is, we basically have this Gaussian regression, what I explained, and then we look, okay, where is the error and variance or a combination of both very high in what we call the joint sampling space. So we look at the coordinates of the different modes plus the parameters. And at those regions where we are unsure, we run for a simulation, in this case, I think 5 seconds, so just a small burst, yes, because all what we'd like to have in these regions is getting the direction of the flow, getting the gradient right. So that is extremely super small samples we need on top. Of course, it's not that easy because you really need to interweave this quite closely with the CFD solver in the background because you need to initialize that with non-constant initial conditions. But if you do so, this is all a very, very feasible computational framework. And in the end, we end up here with 20 real-time, with 20 ODEs. You then can obviously run in real-time on a control, though the use case has been here really for the moment in a system simulation. And the good thing is this is not a neural network. You cannot not interpret, etc. No, this is matrices of size 20 times 20. Well, then plus quadratic terms, etc., but all something very compact and very interpretable. And of course, also, if you would like now to use it, error estimates, etc., this is nothing else than spectral finer elements. As an example, how you could position this just with all the coefficient matrix entries regressed from data, which, thanks to the constraint optimization, looking at smaller trajectories, you can do extremely efficient. Then this is the result, what comes out of this. Okay, I always need to explain what is true, what is predicted. True means for me the high-end CFD simulation with a million cells, and predicted is the 20-dimensional ODE. And I think I forgot here to add the drive cycle on top. Yes, this is a rather complex drive cycle, this car. So it's a battery for a car, this car would be seeing. And then, of course, the temperature is quite significantly changing. And you see a good comparison, at least here at the sensor at the bottom right, close to the cooling channels, and one at the top at the electric bus bars. So the accuracy is really plus minus 1 degree Celsius, and that's really more than sufficient, at least according to the engineers, what they are looking for. And this works for arbitrary complex drive cycles with very, very, very little data. Reason being mostly, well, because we put in so much physics knowledge, yes, how the operators look like, etc. We looked for the right low-dimensional description, used the linear one, nothing fancy nonlinear, etc., etc. The active learning on top, which really allows to work with that little of data. So I would say, from our point of view, this is really a done thing. Yes, we are experimenting, rolling this out now with selected customers for first as prototypes. Of course, there is still some challenges. Yes, if you have convective cooling, etc., then flows get a bit more nasty. But there we also have ideas how to address that, but then going more classically to machine learning approaches. But for the moment, from core mathematical point of view, is I would say we have sufficient understanding to use this broadly. This really reduces the knowledge to realize these real-time models. Yes, today, if you wanted to have such real-time knowledge, it would be a sophisticated engineer putting together, experimenting, building small terminal networks. Probably the same efficiency, but much, much, much resources needed, much, much sophisticated knowledge to build these systems. So that's why also here the time is significantly reduced to build these models, because basically this is now integrated in the classical engineering tools. So the guy setting up the validation case can also generate automatically these reduced order models. Due to a high degree of automation. Now a bit more to the edge, what we would like to do on the modeling side, again, with machine learning. So as you can read in the news, there's many, many people speaking about machine learning to accelerate computational fluid dynamics simulation. So this is typically what everybody speaks about. I would argue, in the end, what people do is, in many cases, multiscale modeling. So I rather prefer to position this as multiscale modeling than acceleration of CFD. Use case we have in mind is really something interactive, real-time computational fluid dynamics for the purpose of, let's say, putting this then later in an agentic engineering workflow, putting that into something more interactive, a designer can try out, whatever. But this is something what in our industry, this interactive computational fluid dynamics is something like the holy grail everybody would like to achieve. And I think we are still a way to go to get there. Maybe not really an agent, many, many different other use cases where this could play a role. Here we are much, much further away from real industrial scale problems, I would say. I'll make an analogy to weather prediction. I think on the weather prediction side, it looks different. But if you go to engineering applications, I think we are further away. So that's why this is really the only benchmark, or not the only benchmark, but this is the benchmark we are going to look in the two or three slides now. As this typical channel flow, the benchmark with a cylinder in the middle, where Stefan Turek came up 20 or 30 years ago to compare all the different solvers, and which you now basically see whenever someone is implementing a new method. Well, then you would have a high fidelity simulation for the sake of demonstrator, 1,000 times 1,000discretization points. And if you would like to make this faster, everybody of us knows, well, you just use a coarser grid. Yes, the complexity scales linearly if you use appropriate solvers with a number of unknowns in this. So this will be, 100 times as fast as the simulation above. But of course, there is an issue here. We are on a coarse grid because we are on a coarse grid. There's many, many phenomena we are not resolving appropriately. And obviously, fine scales matter a lot if you have a turbulence flow. And then the idea is, which many picked up over the last 5 years, can't we use machine learning to model those unresolved scales, unresolved flows? And the good thing is why I like this approach, and why it's also doomed to success in a way is because this is nothing else the turbulence community has been doing over the last 100 years, yes? Finding effective laws to model unresolved scales on a macroscopic scale. There's two ways how we looked at this. The first way is really, and that is how we started looking at this from a solver perspective. So the idea originally, we didn't actually have the multiscale modeling in mind, was, hey, can't we replace specific part in a solver, in a preconditioner, by machine learning? And the core idea here was we use the geometric multigrid grid solver, yes, which has different levels of resolution, and on each of these levels of resolution solves a bit, corrects a bit of the error from what we've currently computed to the correct solution. And here, can't we just cut the very, very top layer and use their neural network to do the defect correction instead of having a classical smoother there? This worked out quite nicely. You'll see on the next page, but then, you know, think a bit more about this. The idea was, okay, if we only do something on the fine scale, isn't this in the end multiscale modeling? And so that is why the second approach really was, can't we have such a multiscale closure on the solvers? So basically, if you put that write that in a neural network graph, yes, have some physics solver, and then in a fashion of an operator splitting, add some neural network model on top as a corrector to correct those predictions. The latter actually, roughly the same time when we looked at the geometric multigrid part, was put forward by Google. That approach, and they used a convolutional neural network to do that correction. A convolutional neural network so means basically they look in the neighborhood, do a convolution, and then use that as a correction. That is a bit difficult to implement in our industrial solvers, just because they are matrix free, and if you would like to do a convolution, actually the convolution they do over 20 to 30 neighbors, so you would need to move quite a lot through memory to find those neighbors and get the information there. That would reduce a bit the efficiency of those solvers, so we worked a lot on how to increase the efficiency, bringing in some tricks there, but I'm not going to talk about this, rather just showing you very quickly to the effect. Roughly said, this is a super simple example, and there's still a long way to go. What you can see here is the horizontal and vertical velocity at the point a little bit behind the obstacle. And then there's compared the high fidelity simulation plus the low fidelity simulation. You see they very quickly get out of sync. Yes, and because this is a highly dynamic phenomena, it doesn't make sense to look really for the accuracy or the comparison of the solution fields. It's typically good to look how fast do they get in sync, what is the typical frequencies you observe, and then you have the machine augmented simulation, which significantly improves while still having a significant speed up. And actually the point here, so that's already an extrapolation case. So this was not trained on the cylinder being at its exact location, but at a different location. But since this is only using a local correction, this generalizes quite well, yes, because it only would like to know how does the local flow look like. It does not matter too much if you move around the cylinder and you still get those good corrections. So very well, extrapolation, as said, still a lot to do here. Where this is working is extremely well is weather prediction. So that team from Google or DeepMind who set forward this accelerated computational fluid dynamics work next on weather prediction. There was 2 years ago a big celebrated model called GraphCast from Google, where they could do enormous weather predictions. The same team this team who worked on this who worked on this approach, took their approach, developed a model called Neural GCM, General Circulation Model. So that's the description of the typical weather or the name of the typical weather models. And they show by using this augmented, this hybrid approach, they could outperform the GraphCast approach by a couple of days in terms of consistency of predictions. And that's why I think this is really a very fascinating way to bring together the two worlds. Yes, the data driven for the fine scale stuff, we probably anyhow don't know. and the large scale, the core stuff to put in there, the energy conservation, so the rigorous physics, etc., because that generalizes well. We've shown you can cope with significantly less data and get more robust predictions. That was just another example there from the first paper. You can look it up in the papers. But this is really all work in progress. But I truly believe a very promising direction to go to combine a bit the best out of those worlds. And yes, then that is all about increasing the accuracy while calculating on course. Grids, reducing compute resources required in the end, making time smaller. And specifically, I think these things are very well suited for immersed boundary methods, for structured voxel-based grids, hexahedral grids, because I've talked a lot about there's lots of manual effort involved in these setting up industrial simulation. Using immersed boundary methods would have an opportunity to reduce that effort, but immersed boundary methods have many, many other challenges to really resolve than the non-conformal discretization, etc. So I do believe there's a big opportunity for these kind of methods. Good. That is more or less the very classical mathematical, or more mathematical, more algorithmic research we are doing in the team. Last 5 minutes I would like to spend to broaden up a bit the horizon and look at the larger field of AI and how that imagines user experience. Because I truly believe this is something we anyhow cannot stop. People will use, yes, if you see all these co-pilots popping up, not only on the coding side, but also on the engineering side. But at the same time, requiring a bit ensuring mathematical rigorousness in these things so that you don't get wrong predictions, and on the other hand, allowing really to broaden the user base. So what is an agent for me? So an agent is more than just a large language model. Yeah? So it has a large language model as a core, but it augments the large language models. Yes, and it augments it by giving it possibilities to retrieve knowledge and to access tools. Obviously, if you'd like to do a prediction, you don't want the large language model to generate your picture, but you want the large language model to use a tool to generate that prediction for you. And you would like to do that on a well-curated set of knowledge. Yes, you don't want that it does this on something it picked up while browsing the internet, whatever, somehow something very implicitly learned, taught into it, but really going back to a very concrete recipe how to do that. And then there is the notion of agents. If you go back to the original definition, well, they should be autonomous, so they have a kind of memory, plan autonomously, etc. But actually what we do is if you would take that to the formal definition, to AI workflows, yes, so it's still very much guided, taking out the autonomy here to having that as controlled as possible. So how does this look like? This is a small demo. I don't know if the sound is working. We'll see. Okay, the sound is not working, so I'm going to talk about this. So the idea is the lady in the bottom right, she is a designer. I don't think design will be automated that soon, yes. So she came up with a very, very nice design for a bracket of an aircraft. That is actually a challenge coming from GE out of when additive manufacturing was a hype, and we built a tool for that, which is actually running here the simulation, so we went back to that. She has no clue about physics. She only got that specification. Yes, this material, these forces. She has no clue what are boundary conditions and the like. So she just gives that specification to the large language model. The large language model figures out where to put the boundary conditions, what is the right material parameters, configures the simulation, runs the simulation in the background, and actually also can provide you a report, which you then can hand over to your simulation expert to still validate. So that is a bit here just to demonstrate what is possible. Yes, that still requires a lot of fine-tuning. Yes, this geometric understanding, where to put really the boundary conditions, etc., is all very customized geometric machine learning models doing that, but still indicates a bit how engineering might look like in the future. And without any simulation expertise, this lady can run the simulation. What you see here in the background is actually this interactive finite element simulation I've showed you in the end, just the product version, which is available as a predictor supporting actually engineers, but still has some hurdles in the capabilities education you need to know where to put boundary conditions, etc. There's only one thing faked in this video. I don't know who of you has guessed. It is the lady in the bottom right. She's completely AI generated. So this is a bit the architecture. I want to speak too much about the architecture, just a bit what does this mean for computer-aided engineering. So we have seen in our industry the need for customization so that non-expert users can use this already since years. But if you would like to do this, you know, non-expert user interface, etc., that requires a lot of hand-coding against APIs, etc. And I think this really is where agents can bring in some big value, that in the future you don't need to hand code stuff against APIs anymore, but you rather have those agents to do the communications, but all that very, very well supervised by engineers so that they strictly followed that knowledge, that recipes fused in before, and of course how to do that appropriately, fail-safe, etc., is a big field of still research. With this, let me wrap up. So I really think these digital twins is a new age of computational paradigms. Specifically, AI and machine learning, everybody believes in. Yes, if you look now at the news, there's tons of people speaking about AI, machine learning in the context of computer-aided engineering towards making these digital twins possible. What I've learned in industry, yes, you need a buzzword, a new buzzword, every few years. So the new buzz for us is physical AI, which basically puts this even to the next level. Yes, it's now really equipping large neural networks, machine learning models with an understanding of the physics and the world around us. And again, a big hype, yes, and specifically, obviously, also in France, yes, with Yann LeCun now getting a very huge evaluation and 1 billion of funding to achieve this. Lots of opportunities. I think in the end, albeit everybody speaks about machine learning, yes, it will be really neat, the mathematics, to fuel this, because otherwise we run in deep, big problems. Yes, it's exciting times, and this is, you know, a car out of a game engine, because most of the stuff you do in robotics is in game engines. But if you only rely on the game engines with this very poor physics, yes, then it might happen that you end up with this in reality. I guess that is nothing anybody of us wants to see. And the good thing is, yes, also the machine learning community starts a bit of criticism, starts to realize that there is a high over-optimism and weak baselines and rigor and clarity is missing. And so I think really bringing in that from a mathematical perspective will make all this possible, whether we've, you know, it will be another 30 years until we make us humans not necessary anymore or not. I'll not speculate on. But yeah, mathematics is crucial to make it happen. This is something I wrote together with a colleague a few years back. So if you look the different elements here, I can point you to that paper. And for that, I'd like to thank for your attention and happy to answer questions.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.